Good morning. It's a funny old world, but you know what they say, time is a great healer, and any other cliche you can think of. But what a real turn up for the books. Who would have believed 13 years after the Saipan showdown that Roy Keane and the FAI head honcho John Delaney would bury the hatchet? On Tuesday, after days of speculation, John Delaney went on the News at One to confirm that Martin O'Neill would be taking over from Trapattoni as the new Ireland soccer manager, with Roy Keane as his beautiful assistant. But of course, Áine Lawler couldn't resist dragging up the past.
So you've been very professional about this and you met Roy. Was this the first time since Saipan last week that you really would have had a proper meeting
with
him?
Well, I suppose Áine's last written about Roy Keane and John Delaney, or Roy Keane and the FAI or whatever it would be. I'd never really spoken to Roy Keane on my own.
But he'd said things about you, and you'd certainly
I replied, said things, yes.
Yeah,
but that's in the past. I suppose, Áine, we all said things that we look in the heat of the moment, or we look back and say, God, I'm sorry I said that, or I shouldn't have said that, or maybe there was a different context at the time. But when we met last week, I was very impressed by him. Very taken.
Surprised by him?
I was very taken by him. I'm very impressed by him. I put it to you that way. And we spoke about the past, I think, for about 30 seconds. And we all agreed, Martin, O'Neill, Roy Keane, myself, that we need to do the best for Irish football. We want to make Irish football great. We want to go to the major tournament in France in 2016. And working together as a team, that's what we expect to do. You know, we met that night. We met the following morning. We've been speaking to him on the phone, text messages, whatever it is, to both Martin and Roy regularly over the last week or so. And everything's been absolutely brilliant so far.
It's not just Saipan, you know. Go back to 2012. There's a lot that Roy Keane said on the record in television studios about the Irish players, about the Irish team. Why is he the man you want walking into the Irish dressing room then?
Because Martin O'Neill is the manager, and Martin wants his backroom staff, and these are the people he wants to be there.
But did you, when you met Roy last week, talk to him about that and the relationship he's going to have to build with the players? I mean, this is all as well in the context of what Alex Ferguson has been saying about his relationship with players at Manchester United.
Yeah, but that's
United.
Martin O'Neill's job. See, Martin's role is manager. So Martin will use his assistant manager in Roy Keane in the way that he wishes to do. And some managers use assistant managers in different ways. I know Roy and Martin have spoken about that in Lent. And I'm sure when Martin is in next Saturday at the press conference, he'll explain how he intends to have Roy in the role.
And later that night, both Martin and Roy appeared together as pundits on ITV as Man U played Real Sociedad in San Sebastian. It was pure box office and all eyes were on the happy couple.
I'm delighted to say that with Lee and me tonight, we have the new Republic of Ireland management team. Congratulations. Martin, the question on everyone's lips, why choose Roy to work with?
I've asked myself that many a time in the last 48 hours, but he's coming with me. Personally speaking, I think he'll be great for me, but more importantly, he'll be great for the Republic of Ireland.
Roy?
No, fantastic news. Delighted, obviously, honoured that Martin's asked me to go and help him with the team. Very excited. I mightn't look it, but I am. And looking forward to working with the players and trying to get to the Euros.
It's a yin and yang. I don't know who's yin and who's yang, but it's a marriage made in heaven, possibly.
Well, I think I'm the bad cop, and I think he's the bad cop. But I think we're excited by it. It looks as if we've got something to go with. I'm looking forward to it greatly.
Of course, the news that Roy is back in the game is pure gold for Oliver Callan. And in fact, we can go live now to that first FAI news conference.
Just to repeat, has everyone flushed their phones down the toilet? Yes. Right. Without further ado, I'm happy to introduce the new management team for the Republic of Ireland senior team.
Get on with it.
Martin O'Neill.
No, the other way around.
Roy,
the other way around.
Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill. And the lads will take any questions now.
Whose camera is that, by the way?
What?
The camera. It keeps going off.
That's my camera, Roy.
Why don't you turn it off?
I have to take bleeding.
Oh, that's great manners. That's what that is.
Right, let's have the first question.
Right, if I can kick off. Of course I can, Tony. You're from Cork after all. Go on.
After so many years out in the cold, how does it feel to be back in the FAI fold?
Well, obviously, as I said, what's wrong with the microphone?
I think it's probably just too close to Martin's. I'll just move it out again.
What'd you do that for? You're after breaking it now, John.
Might I suggest that we could continue without microphones? You know, I'd say myself and Roy are loud enough.
We'll have the next question there, Eamon.
Roy, I'm sure you'll be the first to agree
You used to be a pain in the arse.
Okay, so,
go on.
How do you see this partnership actually working?
Yeah. Well, I think it'll work very well. Yeah. I'm delighted to be here. I may not look it, but I am. This is my happy face.
I can do this really funny happy face where I pull my trouser pockets inside out and get out my...
Ah, for heaven's sake.
Just let Martin in, please.
I think the key to the partnership will be how well Roy and I can relate to the players.
Martin, would you agree that players are substandard or subhuman in some cases?
Well, I would dispute that, actually, Eamon. I think...
Hold on a second, lads.
Whose pacemaker is that?
Sorry?
That's the second time I've heard it.
Second time I've heard what?
I can hear a pacemaker. Do you hear?
That might be mine, Roy. And I'm also from Cork, by the way. Yeah.
You think I care where you come from? That's the second time I've heard that pacemaker. Why don't you turn it off?
Well, I can't do that, Roy, because I probably would actually die. Yeah. So I thought I might just let it beat on, like.
You thought you let it beat on, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's great manners. Great manners, that is.
Just turn it off, Billow, for God's sake. Okie doke.
He's gone blue. He's gone blue, lad.
We're going to have to call an ambulance now. It's another disturbance. What are you waiting for? Somebody phone an ambulance, for God's sake.
We all got rid of our phones, Roy, for the...
I just want to say I never had one in the first place.
I know some CPR, Roy.
Oh, of course you do, Quinny. Motherfucking Teresa. Typical. Whose ambulance is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
Well, that partnership is said to be worth a cool €1 million, but only time will tell if this particular civil partnership survives. Well, the prospect of same-sex marriage came closer on Tuesday with a commitment by an Taoiseach that he would campaign robustly in favour of the referendum on what he called the equality issue of gay marriage. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Rachel English spoke with John Lyons, Labour TD for Dublin North West and co-chair of Labour's LGBT, and Paddy Manning of Preserve Marriage. Paddy is a gay man who is opposed to gay marriage, and judging by this outing, we're facing into yet another contentious referendum.
Is this what he's saying here? Are we now going to devalue all those people who have gone into civil unions? We know from the statistics from the Netherlands and Scandinavia. No, John, I'm going to stay going here because Rachel, I'm appealing to you.
Both of you, we'll let Paddy Manning finish and then I'll come back to you, John Lance.
Oh dear, that referendum is due to be held before the summer of 2015, and let's hope we're not facing into more of that. From Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Well, John Murray made a welcome return to the RTE airwaves this week after a six-month absence, which, as he told listeners, was due to anxiety and depression.
Well, what to say about the last 6 months? One minute I'm happily presenting this radio show and enjoying life. The next I'm gripped by dread and anxiety, with the simplest task proving beyond me. As those with experience of it know, depression doesn't just drop in and say a quick hello and then head for the hills, or at least my kind didn't. No, it took a fancy to me and decided to take up residence for a few months. And boy, did it make its presence felt, especially in the mornings when the day ahead became something to endure rather than enjoy. But in my battle to get better, I discovered that I had in my arsenal a secret weapon, you the listener. I'm so, so grateful to everyone who took the trouble to write to me, send me get well soon cards and mass cards, those of you who rang and texted and emailed the show inquiring after my health, all the people who I met over the last few months in Rathfarnham and Burris and elsewhere. Thanks for making the tougher days a bit easier with your love and concern, and for helping me get back here this morning, and so we can renew our friendship now and have a bit of crack in the process. I'm a little bit reluctant about giving advice to others who might find themselves depressed or anxious. Everyone is different. But one thing I will say is, don't be too hard on yourself. You haven't failed life's test. Share your thoughts and feelings with others and don't suffer in silence. And can I say, finally, to anyone who knows someone who is depressed, don't be afraid to contact them. They mightn't reply immediately or at all, but boy, will they appreciate that someone is thinking of them. I know I did.
And there was huge admiration for John's decision to open out the conversation on depression, and many people commented on his bravery and honesty on the Twitter machine and across the airwaves. Writer and playwright Michael Harding has also experienced bouts of depression. He's written a wonderful book about those dark times called Staring at Lakes, and he had some words of wisdom on how to manage the black dog. He's a big believer in what he calls dozing.
You know, Paul Durkin writes when he's in bed. You know, loads of writers write when they're stretched out. And I have a big stretched out thing beside my stove. It's like it's an armchair I bought for €5 in a mart. And you stretch it out. You can say to people, oh, I'm off to work. You know, I go back to the work. And they think you're in there sweating away at the computer. And you put on the stove and you look out the window. Then you lean back and you have a little doze. And there's a word that's gone out of use too, dozing. Sure, I was only dozing. What's dozing now? You know, now we either sleep or don't sleep or are on tablets. Whereas in the old days, everybody at 50 years of age, they always talk about half an hour of a doze.
We used to have a siesta, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
A long time
ago.
Yeah, but we should reintroduce it.
I think
and
so.
And not feel guilty about.
Not feel guilty. No, allow the darkness in there when you doze. Allow the loneliness, allow the depression. But also allow the magic, the love stories, the just sense of, God, isn't that tree outside lovely?
Yeah.
And doze away and listen to the fire.
Michael Harding. Well, many callers to Liveline had their own stories to tell, and while Kate found John Murray's story inspirational, the reality for her was difficult. Her ex-husband suffered with depression and mental illness, and trying to cope with it on a daily basis had made her own life a living hell.
And you say in your situation, your partner did talk about depression. He talked about little else.
He talked about it continually, morning, noon and night, when he was in a state of depression. And I listened morning, noon and night.
And what would he be saying?
He would basically say about how bad he felt and try to talk about it and try to get me to understand how bad he felt. The word suicide and suicide ideation became part of our daily conversation in periods throughout our life together.
What, he threatened suicide or talked about
it? He threatened suicide. He had many suicide attempts. And, you know, you get to the stage that when you're doing the washing and you put shirts in the washing machine, you're looking for blood on the sleeves because of the fact that he may have slashed his wrists. You look in slippers because there might be blood in the slippers where somebody slashed the soles of their feet. And this becomes commonplace. You count the number of Prozac left in a package because you know by looking at the person that they haven't taken the medication. And there would be periods, obviously, in good periods, you know, in somebody's life. But it's a cloud that hangs over not just the person, but the family. And in a dark period of time, you know, I remember situations where I would drive home from work and say it was the winter, which would always be a bad time. So you might drive down the road and there's no lights on in the house. And you park the car in the drive, you have a beautiful daughter, leave her in the car, walk in to make sure that he hadn't taken an overdose or that he wasn't hanging from the rafters, and then make the excuse that you're going in to put on the heating. Then bring my daughter in.
My God. And then you see, if, again, this constant talk of was it how unfair the world is to him, the situation he's in. At nighttime in bed, you'd fall asleep from exhaustion.
Well, yeah, because I held down a full-time job, as did he, and successfully. But the thing about it was, if this person gets extremely stressed or whatever, or they're worried about something, or they get an idea into their head, that's all they can focus on. And, you know, if they felt aggrieved about something, they would talk about it non-stop. And you just fall asleep because you're exhausted.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Tuesday. Well, tomorrow night, everyone in our house will gather round the television for the finale of the RTÉ series Love Hate. And yesterday I was listening to writer and director Peter Sheridan, who's also a fan, and he summed up just why the series has been such a hit.
It's not the stock Dublin inner city criminality, you kind of tenement buildings and all the old cliches, you know, Sheriff Street flats and Buckingham Street and the inner city and all of that world. And now we're in this other world where, you know, Nidge lives in a nice house. It's apartment blocks. It's a kind of a flashy side to Dublin. I mean, it has a tremendous pace as a television series. It has really found its niche in that it really lets the camera linger on the characters' faces. It's not afraid for silence. Now, when you have the bravery and the confidence to just allow the camera to stay on the characters and allow the characters' inner lives to kind of appear before us, that takes a lot of guts, a lot of balls, and they've really found our niche for me in terms of narratively how they tell the story with very little dialogue. There's scenes like where Charlie Murphy is watching her boyfriend kind of as he is falling apart, and she just looks at him and starts crying. That's the scene. It isn't anything else. And they have the confidence to do that without putting in the 20 lines of dialogue. It's not really a plot-driven series. It's a series that's completely driven by your belief in these characters. And of course, you've got the great anti-hero in Neji, like the guy who you love to follow because he is just so contradictory, so awful, so compelling. Just Tom Von Lawler has really gotten under the skin of that guy.
He has
and made it a really one of the great, great performances in Irish television of the last 30 years.
Peter Sheridan with John Murray yesterday. Well, far away from lowlifes and crime and Nidgeland, there's the beauty of the All-Ireland School Choir competition, which is also broadcast on Sunday nights. It's the brainchild of RTÉ's Northern editor Tommy Gorman, and the idea is to encourage the tradition of choral music in secondary schools. Here's a taster, the choir from Strathairn School in East Belfast with the Seal Lullaby. And you can see that All-Ireland School Choir competition on RTÉ television tomorrow evening at 5:10, presented by Anne Casson.
Playback on RTÉ Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
It's 2 years now since RTÉ's Áine Lawler was diagnosed with breast cancer. Today, she's cancer-free and her recovery has been well documented. But she's become something of a campaigner to increase awareness of the advancements in cancer medicine and the difference it's making to people's lives. She spoke with John Murray about her mission and the television series she's just made called Facing Cancer.
I remember one day one of the drips was going into my arm, and the kind of cancer I had, there was a new medicine that had only come along in the past decade, and it had turned my kind of cancer from having some of the worst outcomes in breast cancers to having some of the best cancers and outcomes in breast cancers. So obviously, from my point of view, that was really, you know, fortunate. But it was one of the days that the drip was going in and I realised that medicine wasn't around in my mother's time. I was on a trial for an even newer generation of this kind of medicine as well, the combination of the two plus chemotherapy. So it struck me that this was a fantastic story. Cancer is a story, and the story of cancer medicine, it's actually a really good thriller, because cancer in many ways is, it's a sneaky enemy and it's a perverse enemy. And when you can stand back, there's people in cancer wards every day of the week. There's people who are going through much worse things than I had to go through. There's people for whom the treatment these days, you know, it's an episode. The treatment actually deals with it without too much side effects and intrusion, and they're able to get on with their lives. So there's a whole gamut there. And I felt very much that I wanted to just bring that to people's attention and create a space where more people can talk about cancer, the issues that arise from it. And, you know, the rate's 1 in 3. In Ireland, it's going to double in the next 25 years. That's the, you know, the bad news. The good news is the medicine is changing what the disease is. So there's good and bad in it, and I think if we face it, we'll all do better.
One of the people Áine interviewed for her series was Tim Shaffrey. Tim was at school in St Mary's College in Rathmines in Dublin when his cancer struck.
When I was 13, it would have been the August going into my first year in St Mary's College, and I found a lump on one of my testicles, so it was testicular cancer. But because of the age and because I was so young, I was so embarrassed of it, I didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything right throughout the year. And then in May, I got a lump on my neck. I even didn't at that point make any connection between the two. And I was due to go away on a rugby trip. And my parents decided, you know, you need to go get this checked out. Went to my GP. My GP didn't like the look of it. And within the space of 2 days, I was in Crumlin getting surgery. But even it went to this point that I was in Crumlin before the surgery being talked to by an oncologist who said, look, you have cancer. It's most likely a certain type. And at that point, I still didn't mention the testicular end of it. So it took a CT scan for them to really understand what was going on. And it went from what would have been a very simple procedure of chemo and then maybe removing it. And then I would have been fine into, that was 8 years ago. And I'm still in and out. Like I'm not, nothing on the cards now, but I've had, you know, 14 surgeries to date, a few months of chemo. And it's just been a very long, drawn out saga.
And what's the outlook now?
Hopefully it holds no more future treatment in terms of surgeries or chemo. But it is a constant, you know, every few months into hospital for checkups. But I don't let that kind of get into my personal life or what I'm doing in college anymore, because if I did, it would just be a killer. You wouldn't be able to do anything.
No.
Tim Shaffrey and the second part of Áine Lawlor's documentary series on cancer will be broadcast next Thursday. On The Mooney Show, Derek's guest was Dr. Kate Coleman. Kate is an eye surgeon at the Blackrock Clinic and founder of the charity Right to Sight, which has outreach programmes in South Africa and India. Kate has only recently returned to work as a surgeon after being seriously ill.
I joined the very elite group of women in Ireland. Sadly, the figure comes up to about one in three women that got cancer. It was a very interesting experience, actually. I'm far the better for it. But then let's not forget that if I was living in Africa right now, in Somalia, I would be dead. So it's very difficult to complain when you keep in mind that I have friends living in Africa who'd be dead if they had the same diagnosis. The only thing that interests me is that statistically, we are far more likely to get cancer living in Ireland or in America or in England than in an awful lot of other countries. You know, the highest incidence in the world is in America, 110 per 100,000. Ireland is number two. England is number three. And so, you know, you have that little dilemma. We are far more likely to get cancer. Why is that?
Why is that? Exactly.
I personally am convinced it's related to a lot of the toxins in the food, and toxins in the food, hormones in food, toxins in creams, hormones in plastics, hormones in creams. And then the diet. You know, in India, they have 9 cases per 100,000 compared with our 91. And they would include things like the average Indian would have a teaspoon of turmeric in their diet every day, just naturally. And these are very, very powerful ingredients for switching off cells that could be about to be switched on and start doubling up as cancer cells. So the accepted theory of cancer now is that, yes, one can be genetically predisposed, but generally speaking, there are lots of little cells that potentially can become cancers in any body.
And Kate Coleman has a very philosophical take on life and death.
Can I ask you, this is going to be the hardest question I've got to ask you. Did you at any stage think you weren't going to make it?
Let's rephrase it. Did I ever care that I wasn't going to make it?
Okay. Did you ever care you were never going to make
no.
it? You didn't
so,
really? Why?
No. Again, it's the way I've always lived my life. I have absolutely no fear about death. Never did. Never will. And so it's a mystery to me. You know, how am I going to live? How am I going to die? I'm just watching it. It's like watching the movie being played. And I think I'm quite lucky that I have that faith. So when I was diagnosed, I remember sitting back going, so this is how a lot of my problems are going to be solved. Seriously, because I was working far too hard, and suddenly I had a license. First of all, I had to go off and incubate and get better, but also a lot of people suddenly came on board to help me. I was very, very sick. So, you know, I could easily die from it. But it doesn't matter, because I'm intent on having a great time anyway. And that's the way we should all be living our lives.
Dr. Kate Coleman with Derek Mooney on Wednesday. Another person who's made a difference is Jesuit priest Peter McVerry, who's been providing support for homeless people and drug addicts in Dublin for close on 40 years. Father McVerry is to be made a free man of Dublin next year, along with rugby legend Brian O'Driscoll. And he spoke with Cathal McQuillia on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
Well, first, I'm very honoured by the award, very grateful to the Lord Mayor, Oisín Quinn, and to Dublin City Council for offering it. Also very humbled by it, especially in the company of somebody like Brian O'Driscoll. I mean, Brian has extraordinary achievements to his name. He's won every award, every honour in rugby, the rugby world that you can win. I look at myself, what's my achievement? As you say, nearly 40 years of trying to eradicate or reduce homelessness. And at the end of the day, it's worse than ever. So not much of an achievement, I must have to say. I would hope that it would highlight the problem of homelessness once again. There is absolutely no need for anybody to be homeless in Dublin or in Ireland, even in the middle of a recession.
One of the key elements in addressing the situation, I know in your view, is the provision of rapid housing for individuals in their own accommodation. And some of that is happening. How much and how much more is needed?
The big blockage at the moment is there is very little social housing available to people who are homeless. I mean, it's so obvious the solution to homelessness is to provide people with a home. I mean, you have to do more than that, but that's the bottom line at the end of the day. And it is becoming more and more impossible for homeless people to get a home. They are at the bottom of the social housing waiting list because the majority of homeless people are single or separated, and so they have low priority. And there is the access to private rented accommodation now is becoming more and more difficult.
Father Peter McVerry, soon to get grazing rights in Dublin. I often wonder what motivates someone to step outside their comfort zone. Stephen Donnelly is now an independent TD for Wicklow and East Carlow, but as he told Marion Finucane, he only became politicised while watching Ireland's banking crisis unfold from the comfort of his armchair. And although clueless about the mechanics of politics, he ran for the Dáil, arguing for the renegotiation of our bank debt and the setting up of a national reconstruction bank.
I decided, I think I'll give it a go. And I made one final phone call to a friend of mine who used to work with the Green Party. He's the only person I knew who'd actually knocked on doors. And I said, Simon, can I win? There's no point doing this if there's no chance I can get in. And he said, yes, you can. And if you run, sorry, Green Party. He said, I was going to campaign for the Green Party. Now I'll campaign for you. And that was the final thing where I said, OK, I'll give it a go. So that's where it came to.
Right.
And as Susan reminded me this morning before I left, she said, don't forget that she had said to me, Stephen, with all the giving out you've done and all the armchair expertise you've been giving, if you don't run, I never want to hear you complain about Irish politics again. And I thought, well, that's not an option. So, So I better go in.
And his first day was memorable.
The first day. Oh, well, I knew so little. I'd never been in the Dáil. So, you know, you wake up after the returning officer says, and elected to the Dáil is Stephen Donnelly and all the others. And you think, well, what do I do? Because I wasn't in a party, you know. So I think I slept for about a day and a half and then said, well, sure, I better go in. You know, kind of almost like had my lunchbox my first day of school. So got off the dart. I walked up Merrion Street to the entrance and there were two guards there, two tall young guards. And I said, hey guys, you know, Stephen Donnelly reporting for duty. I'm newly elected. And the two guys, to their credit, total professionalism, they never cracked a smile, but their eyes, you could see the smile kind of creeping into their eyes. Said, deputy, congratulations. It's a wonderful honour. This is the Museum of Natural History. They said, you'll be looking for the Dáil, and directed me around to Kildare Street. So that'll give you an idea of how little I knew going in.
Stephen Donnelly in conversation with Marion Finucane. Well, getting elected as mayor in a hugely competitive city like Boston in the United States is also not for the faint-hearted. And this week, two men of Irish extraction slugged it out for the main prize. Marty Walsh is the son of Connemara emigrants. His father's from Califeenish in Carna and his mother from Rossmuck. They emigrated to the States in the early 50s. And John Connolly is also Irish-American. Well, political analyst Larry Donnelly, himself a son of Boston, gave Rachel English the background to the race.
They're two Irish-Americans, I suppose, with different life stories. They're both city kids. They both grew up in Boston. Marty Walsh is the son of immigrants from Connemara. His father is from Cana. His mother is from Rossmuck. He went into the Labourers' Union, worked his way up, eventually got elected state representative and a union leader. John Connolly, on the other hand, he grew up in the city as well, but his father was Massachusetts Secretary of State. His mother was a judge. He went to Harvard. He went to Boston College Law School and was a corporate lawyer and then got elected to the Boston City Council. So they do have different life stories.
Now, does it make any difference the fact that whatever happens today, there's going to be somebody of an Irish background in power in Boston?
I think it does. I think it speaks to a couple of things. I think intangibly, the benefits of having an Irish-American leader in a powerful position like being mayor of Boston can serve on in a number of different ways. I know in particular, Matty Walsh is very committed to Galway and to the Connemara region specifically. So it has those intangible benefits that are there in a very real way. And I think also, if we look at the issue of the undocumented Irish, I think that both of them will be champions for the undocumented Irish. So I think that can have a big knock-on effect. But I think, Rachel, the other thing is, a lot of people thought that the day of the big city Irish Catholic, Irish American mayor was over. But these are two different types of Irish Americans. They're both genuine progressives who have courted votes very aggressively in the minority community and who have done very well and have stand on issues like education, diversifying the police force, diversifying public services. So they're a different breed of Irish American politician.
Who's going to win?
My suspicion, with all the momentum and the surge, is that Matty Walsh will win this, but it's going to be very close and every vote's going to count.
Larry Donnelly, is he psychic or what? Marty Walsh was indeed elected the 48th mayor of Boston. Well, the first edition of Radio 1's new books and publishing programme, The Book Show, presented by Sinead Gleeson and produced by Zoe Gibson, aired last Saturday night at 7, and it marked the life and work of the writer Maeve Brennan, who left Ireland at the age of 17 and who apparently dazzled all who met her with her wit and her beauty. She was also a seriously talented social observer, and her writings in The New Yorker magazine drew a large and loyal readership. Well, unfortunately, Maeve ended her days as a bag lady on the streets of Manhattan, alone and alcoholic, as her biographer Angela Burke told Sinead Gleeson.
The thing that distresses me, I suppose, for Maeve, because I feel that I know a lot about her life at this stage, is how public her later years had to be. You know, we talk about, say, domestic violence among poorer people and how visible that is among travellers, for instance, or something, whereas domestic violence among better off people is behind closed doors. And Maeve's disintegration and her later years were lived in a kind of horrible glare of publicity and were commemorated because, of course, she was living among writers. They were commemorated. She, I think, was quite comfortable in her later years, but it's certainly true that after the Vietnam War, when, you know, when the culture changed, when she was in her 50s, she didn't really change with it. You know, Ellen was talking about her as a transatlantic writer, and really her heyday was the day of the great ocean liners. And she was born for ocean liners. She was on her first one at 17, and she came back and forth across the Atlantic many, many times on those liners in that elegant world that they produced. And even the early days of air travel, again, suited her down to the ground. But then when air travel got a bit more common and when it was easier to come back, somehow she lost the pedals or she didn't manage it so well.
Angela Burke, biographer of Maeve Brennan, heard on The Book Show last Saturday night. Well, one of the strangest stories this week was that of the young woman who was found in a distressed state in O'Connell Street in Dublin last month. She was detained under the Child Care Act, believed to have been a child victim of human trafficking. But no one knew how she got here or where she came from. And Gardaí took the unusual step of releasing her photo to try to identify her. The story took another remarkable twist on Wednesday when she was identified as a 25-year-old Australian. Well, happily, the woman is now home and in the care of her family in Australia. But as ever, Oliver Callan had his own special take on that story.
So exciting to be in Dublin to see the Christmas lights going up.
Yeah, righto. It feels really festive, don't it?
All right. I'm sorry there, little missy. I'll have to ask you to come with us.
What? Is there a problem, officer?
Well, it is for your own protection, love. I saw you there looking up at the sky and you looked a bit vulnerable there.
Oh, no. We were just admiring the lights.
Yeah, you're obviously a bit dazed. Trafficked in, were you, huh?
I beg your pardon?
The old sexy old trafficking, is it? Breaks my heart every time to see it. An innocent child like you.
Child?
God love you.
I'm 47, mate.
Yara, we only have your word for that now, little girlene.
No, he's my passport.
Give me a look at that. Jesus, that's amazing what they can do nowadays. That really is something, huh? It even looks a bit like you too. Now, come on, it's getting dark.
What?
We need to get you into secure accommodation before nightfall for your own safety, like.
But I'm staying in the Gresham. It's at the top of the street.
Now, don't be making this more difficult for yourself. Come on with
what?
Me now.
Get off me, you flaming glass.
Don't be struggling now. And you stay away from here if you don't want me to arrest you.
But I'm a sister.
Huh?
And this is a niece.
Niece? A likely story. Give us a look at her here, will you?
I don't want to take her out of her pram in the cold.
You give her here now by order of Angarda Shiacana. Tis just as I expected. She doesn't look like either of you at all. For starters, she's bald. Right, she'll have to come as well. Come on now, the whole lot is into the van.
This is a bloody joke.
Come on, don't be resisting arrest.
What is this?
Get off! What's going on?
Come on, children!
My baby!
I have to protect you!
Leave her alone! Get my baby, you dingo!
Now we've got it!
What sort of a country is this?
The Gathering. Come to Ireland. Not only do we care, we put you into care.
We have to protect the children!
He's bowled. Oliver Callan heard on Callan's Kicks last night. Well, it seems we'll never fully escape the legacy of violence in the North, despite our best efforts. Yet again this week, there was renewed focus on the alleged role of Gerry Adams in the abduction and killing of Belfast mother Jean McConville, with the broadcast of the television programme The Disappeared. On Drive Time, RTÉ's Northern editor Tommy Gorman and commentator Fionnuala O'Connor discuss the impact of the programme and whether it would hasten Gerry Adams' departure as Sinn Féin leader.
Was damage inflicted on Gerry Adams by last night's documentary?
There's ongoing damage over the whole Jean McConville affair. And of course, it comes back to Gerry Adams and whether he was in the IRA or not. At the time Gerry Adams denied being a member of the IRA, he was involved in the slow march of the Republican movement away from armed struggle towards exclusively political means. And at the time the question was first put to him, had he admitted, yes, I was a card-carrying senior member of the IRA, it could have involved a prison sentence immediately. So, of course, in those circumstances, he denied it. And his difficulty now is any change in that position would leave him open to the accusation that, look, you said this once upon a time and now you're saying something completely different. So in some respects he's trapped, and the Jean McConville story and the story of the disappeared is an extension of that whole situation. So it remains an issue for him, yes, Mary.
So the cumulative impact last night, Fionnuala O'Connor, of so many stories being told in that documentary, but how will Gerry Adams look at what he saw on television last night, and how will he assess the impact on his political career?
I don't know that there's any new damage inflicted on him. It may for him be very near the end of what one person can soak up in terms of being required to replay it and answer questions all the time. But he's such a disciplined creature, and that is such a disciplined organisation still, that what he feels is not going to affect what he does next. Okay. In other words, I don't think he's going to jump in the near future, and I don't think he's going to be made jump.
Fionnuala O'Connor and Tommy Gorman with Mary Wilson. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Wednesday, and despite his best efforts, over 15 years on from the Good Friday Agreement, the parties are still stuck.
Do you have any fears at all that there could be a return to those bad days?
I think it's as well to be vigilant because, you know, these processes are very fragile. I mean, I spend a lot of time out in the Middle East right now on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And, you know, you see once again in these situations that even if you make progress, there is an inherent fragility because things have been so bad in the past and there's still a lot of bitterness there. And also, by the way, one of the most difficult aspects of anything like this is it only requires a few more extreme people to upset the thing for everybody.
It's astonishing, really, though, when you think of it, that huge amounts of trade and probably cross-border visitors were lost to Belfast as recently as last Christmas because of a row over the flying of the Union flag over City Hall in Belfast. How would you deal with something like that?
Well, I think the only way you can deal with it is the way they're dealing with it, because look, for an outsider, I mean, you can't quite comprehend it, but let me tell you, you only have to talk to the parties involved for a short period of time to realise that for them it's something they care passionately about. So you have to try and find a way through. But, you know, I agree, of course, what you've just said indicates how much people have got to gain from peace and how much they've got to lose, also if they go back to the past.
Sean O'Rourke with Tony Blair on Wednesday.
Playback on RTÉ Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
The winds of change are certainly blowing in the Church of Ireland. It has appointed a female bishop for the first time in its history. The Reverend Pat Storey is well used to mixing it in a man's world, but as she told Eileen Dunn on The God Slot last night, gender is a secondary issue for her.
You said that you were excited and daunted by the appointment.
Yes.
How significant is it for you that you're the first woman bishop in these islands?
I never know what to make of it when people say that, you know, women are more this or they're less that, because obviously that's stereotyping and it's not always true. I mean, I do think women tend to be collegial. And I think they tend to be focused on relationships and community. And I suppose I bring, you know, I'm the first wife and mother on the House of Bishops, or I will be. So I suppose that, you know, that brings a unique perspective, I think. You know, I think wives and mothers tend to be collegial and tend to be geared towards the needs of those around them, tend to be nurturing. But having said that, you know, I know a lot of men who are collegial and who are nurturing, and I know some women who aren't. Okay. So I'm not sure that you can, you know, really stereotype.
From the God Slot last night. And there was another milestone this week, this time for jockey Tony McCoy. Yesterday, Sean O'Rourke outlined his achievements with his guest, Ted Walsh.
Looking at some of the statistics, career winners 4,000. His first victory in Thurles was 1992. Winners at Newton Abbott, 264. Weeks as champion jockey, 936. Prize money won 35 million. Miles travelled each year, 75,000. Average winners in the last 20 years, 24%. Winners in 2001, 2002, 289. Cheltenham Festival winners, 29. Bookmakers lost in the 2010 Grand National, 50 million. We were speaking of none other than Tony McCoy. What a man, Ted. What can you add to all of that by way of explanation?
Absolutely nothing, only he's to boot with all that too. It has never affected him along the way. He's the same fella as he was 20 years ago. He's unassuming. He appreciates the good fortune he had. He is just a good fella. Usually these fellas that are that high profile, it affects him along the way, but it definitely hasn't affected AP. I've watched him all his life, and I would say he's riding as good now, if not better, than he was 10 years ago.
Ted Walsh. Well, over on Countrywide, Damien O'Reilly was reporting from the Middle East, and while there, he met up with Irish vet Frank McGovern, originally from County Cavan. He's the manager of the King Stud and Livestock Farm.
Tell us where we are now.
We're here in this is the Arabian division of the King's Farm. This is where we have all the Arabian horses, and the actual area we're standing in is the VIP presentation area.
Right, and the King also has a working farm here.
Yeah, this would be the equivalent of, you know, the Americans refer to it as the Camp David of Saudi Arabia. It's a large working farm. We've got horses, cattle, sheep. It's a large complex. It's probably around 6 miles long, mile wide. And it's very much a working farm. We produce race horses. We produce Arabian show horses. We have a dairy herd that produces 4 tons of dairy products per day. We have a 5,000 sheep unit, and we have about 7 acres of greenhouses that produce all the vegetables for the royal court. Yeah, all of his food comes from the farm. So wherever he's in the world or wherever he's in the kingdom, that food gets shipped to him.
Well, it sounds impressive, but it's not all about extravagance, as Frank explained.
The operative word with King Abdullah and his family is functionality. You know, people would be surprised to hear that we work on very strict budgets. You know, they want to have racehorses, they want to have a large farm, and we can sit down with them and work out what that's going to cost. But, you know, we are not allowed to deviate from our budgets, and everything, you know, is carefully thought through. We plan well in the future, and, you know, we try to achieve what they want us to achieve within those budgets. But definitely extravagance is out.
All right. That probably suits you, being a Cavan man.
Absolutely. And seeing that you are married to a Cavan woman, you should appreciate it even more.
Cavan vet Frank McGovern giving as good as he got from Damien O'Reilly on Countrywide. On Thursday night's Arena, A.B. Philbin Bowman profiled the YouTube sensation and award-winning comedian Bo Burnham. Here's a taster of Burnham's trademark style of musical comedy.
Entertainers like to seem complicated, but we're not complicated. I can explain it pretty easily. Have you ever been to a birthday party for children, and one of the children won't stop screaming because he's just a little attention attractor? When he grows up to be a comic or actor, he'll be rewarded for never maturing, for never understanding or learning that every day can't be about him. There's other people, you selfish asshole. I must be psychotic, I must be demented to think that I'm worthy of all this attention, of all of this money you worked really hard for. I slept in late while you worked at the drugstore.
Bo Burnham, heard on A.B. Philbin Bowman's report for Arena on Thursday. I hope you'll stay tuned for George Lee on The Business, but I leave you now with a song from Michelle Lally with Frankie Gavin and De Dannan, and they played live for Sean O'Rourke in Galway yesterday. Gurumago Vasfor Goluther, Tasulam Gurwanchiv Saltasaglor, Agus Gemeshiv Lam Takanamakin on Tachtan Chahugin, Gajishin, Gajishib Slan.
2, 3, 4.
Did you hear the news that's going round? Down in the corner of my heart, a love that
eyes are blue. They seem to whisper, darling boy, my love is all for you. Oh, Molly, my Irish Molly, my sweet cushion beans, my belly of my jolly, my Irish Molly, when you are near. Springtime, you know it's springtime. Come dear, debt. It's all complete except they haven't brought the cradle yet. Oh,